With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us this morning on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, the USDA is expecting a larger California almond crop. We'll have details on that. But our top story today, California Representative John Duarte says the nation should be more concerned about slave labor in the Congo than how U.S. pigs are housed for production. Duarte was a featured speaker on Capitol Hill during the National Association of Farm Broadcasting's legislative visit earlier this month. When asked about California's Prop 12, he had this.
I mean, this is disgusting, and I've got a few ways I'm responding to this. We care about how many piggies there are in a pig pen. We care about how a chicken lays an egg, although I don't think most of the people supporting these policies really know of either. On moral grounds, there's no documented animal welfare issue or anything else. This is just somebody's morality exercised in policy in California affecting the affordability of animal protein.
He says moral grounds should apply to things like production of electric cars, which use minerals mined in the Congo.
It is the most abject colonialism and slavery that we've seen in the history of the world. It's industrialized slavery in the Congo. And we are subsidizing electric vehicles made with these critical minerals out of these inhuman mines.
Duarte said his legislative focus is on the humans.
If you want an electric vehicle, great. I'm sure you'll look cute in it. But if you want a federal rebate, we have to document that these electric vehicles that we're subsidizing through taxpayer dollars are not made of constituents or components produced with slave labor. Now, I'm a lot more concerned about human slave labor through our proxy imperialism through China in the Congo than I am about telling a farmer who raises pigs and is a very economic and deep interest in their health and welfare, simply for financial reasons, if nothing else, how to raise a pig.
Congressman John Duarte. Atmospheric conditions were behind what was a significant April concerning tornado counts in the U.S., just as the peak of the nation's tornado season took place. Rod Bain reports.
1 month down, two more to go.
April, May, and June represents the peak of the U.S. severe weather season. That is the time of year where we see our greatest numbers of not only isolated tornadoes, but also significant or severe thunderstorm winds and large hail.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says this past April illustrated that significant upturn in tornadic activity after a relatively quiet first 3 months of 2024.
Given the fact that we saw a mild winter and a general lack of extreme cold, it's not really a surprise. When you add to that the fact that we've had a very active El Nino-related storm track heading into spring, that we would have an early peak of that severe weather season.
With the last week of April particularly active tornado-wise.
If you look at April of 2024, the preliminary number coming in from the National Weather Service Storm Prediction Center indicates that we saw 373 tornadoes, a lot of them occurring right at the end of the month, either the 25th through the 28th or the 30th. But we did see some earlier outbreaks that occurred between April 1st and 2nd, the 9th through the 11th, and the 15th through the 18th.
In terms of how this past April measures with prior years regarding tornado counts.
In the National Weather Service, they use a 30-year average. So if you look at the latest 30-year period that we have the records for, 1991 to 2020, the average number of tornadoes across the United States for the month of April is just 193. So we were almost double that 30-year average total with our account of 373 for April 2024.
Rippey says in the 21st century, there was only one April recording more tornadoes than this year.
That was the historic and deadly 2011, a year where we saw more than 550 U.S. tornado-related fatalities through the course of the year. That April featured an all-time record 817 tornadoes across the United States, hopefully a number that we'll never approach again. But again, to put that in perspective, this year's 373, if that number holds up, would rank as the number two in the 21st century.
He adds the early peak to and increased activity in this year's tornado season lent itself to climatic conditions in April.
A lot of energy coming in from the Pacific. It has been entering the country through the west or the northwest primarily. And then as those systems work their way across the Great Plains, we have a very nice temperature gradient where the storms can work with the cool air to the north, the warm, humid air coming in from the Gulf of Mexico and the Atlantic. And with a lot of the dynamics there, it doesn't take much of a spark to get these big storms rolling on a daily basis, with the activity peaking in the afternoon and evening and lasting into the overnight hours.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Clutter around the house, the farm, or in the shop silently takes up mental space and can make it harder for you to focus on the task at hand. Michael Klimitz has more.
AARP Oklahoma State Director Sean Voskel says it's important from time to time to stop, look around, and remove some clutter. The good news is there are many ways you can sell your unused items for cash.
Thanks to technology, it's never been easier to declutter. From online auctions, live auctions, social media sites, estate sales, and more, there are many avenues you can consider to match your pace of decluttering. Just remember to stay vigilant on online marketplaces, as they can be full of scammers.
And that extends beyond the home.
Perhaps what can be even more valuable to sell is the miscellaneous items that tend to pile up around the farm. Old equipment, vehicles, and even old tools around the farm and shop. Taking some time to consider what these items mean to the future of the farm and selling the ones you really don't need can keep the farmyard looking cleaner and put some cash in your pocket.
Voskel offers these tips for the decluttering process.
We feel the pain of losing something more strongly than the pleasure of getting something, and we tend to overvalue things that we own. Ask yourself, how much would I pay for this if I really didn't own it? How much do I really need the item? It's far better to de-own than declutter.
Learn more Thursday night at 9 p.m. Central Time on RFD TV or online at aarp.org/AARP Live. Michael Klimitz reporting.
You're listening to the AgNet NewsHour. In today's national spotlight, some cattle producers in the Dakotas are pushing back against proposed federal rules for mandatory electronic ID tags for their cattle. Rusty Halverson has more.
Senator Mike Grounds of South Dakota has introduced legislation that would prevent the Secretary of Agriculture from implementing any rule or regulation requiring the mandatory use of electronic identification tags or RFID tags on cattle and bison. In January of 2023, USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service published a proposal to require cattle and bison to have visually and electronically readable tags. The proposed rule would also require records to be entered into a tribal, state, or federal database, allowing the federal government to access this information. Sam Wagner, ag organizer for the Dakota Resource Council, says his group supports the legislation.
We do feel that if people want to speak up about this, that their best course of action would be to contact our Senators Kramer and Hoven and let them know that they support Mike Rounds' legislation as well.
Corey Hart, a fifth-generation cow-calf operator near Chaseley, North Dakota, has questions and concerns about mandatory EID requirements.
We do feed some Montana cattle where they would have to be EID'd before they come into the state of North Dakota and resold at a sale barn, or the sale barn will have to put the EIDs in at the sale barn at the producer's cost and expense. So there's a lot that we don't know. The handbook's not out on it yet.
Wagner says the Dakota Resource Council and the Independent Beef Association of North Dakota, or IBAND, will be talking about the topics of EID, country of origin labeling, the beef checkoff, and the farm bill at an event scheduled for early June in Bismarck.
We are calling it the Enough is Enough Tour. It's called A Conversation About Ranching. It's going to be Tuesday, June 4th at the Kennedy Center, 1902 Divide Avenue in Bismarck, North Dakota. 4 p.m., we'll be having a panel discussion, and 5:30, we'll be having a social hour.
Regarding another topic that will be discussed at the June meeting, the Dakota Resource Council would like to see democratic elections for members of the North Dakota Beef Commission rather than appointments by the North Dakota governor.
We brought up a bill in the previous session that would change the North Dakota Beef Commission from being a governor-appointed position to being split up into eight districts that would be elected by the members of the checkoff. And I think one of the things that we're looking at in this conversation is one of the topics brought up in this panel discussion is how can we work with lawmakers to alleviate concerns that they might have about this system and just draw up and write up decent legislation that will address the issues that they had in the previous 2023 session. And we want to try and build support to get this bill over the hump in the 2025 session.
Wagner says they also plan to discuss the OFF Act, federal legislation regarding checkoff programs in general.
The OFF Act is a piece of legislation that is addressing a bigger problem that we seem to have in the checkoff in general.
The conversation about ranching will be held Tuesday, June 4th at the Kennedy Center in Bismarck at 4 p.m. More information can be found at the Dakota Resource Council Facebook page. I'm Rusty Halverson.
That's today's National Spotlight. Now here's the livestock report from John Harith.
Beef industry leaders from across the U.S. are in South Korea and Japan this week examining U.S. Meat Export Federation activities to promote U.S. beef in the region, made possible by the Beef Checkoff. Cattlemen's Beef Board Chairman Andy Bishop says the group has seen firsthand how the promotions are building carcass value.
You know, that's something that back in the States we have a hard time understanding is what are residents consuming here in South Korea and Japan, and it's short plate, short rib, chuck roll, chuck flaptail, those type products that we wouldn't normally see at home and don't consume much at home, but they can send those over here and add value to that carcass. And the way they prepare those, I actually called my butcher while I was here and said, hey, no more short ribs the way we do them at home. I want mine thinly sliced like they've got them here in South Korea because they're pretty amazing.
He says having staff on the ground in foreign markets offers a key advantage for U.S. red meat.
I think about South Korea in general in 2008, that people boycotting in the streets about U.S. beef coming out of BSE. And you think about even back to 1975 when they were eating 14 pounds of total meat a year per capita. And now they're eating 134 pounds. So when you tell producers, what's USMEF doing with your checkoff dollars in that export market? You can say, well, they're adding $454 of value to a carcass by utilizing cuts of meat that we're not going to consume in the United States. And we may, but we're going to consume it at a much lower value, right? And so I think that's a story that you can tell. We can send those cuts over here, build a demand for U.S. beef that Asian consumers enjoy, but not without the work of the USMEF. And so I think it's really important to remember that if we didn't have boots on the ground over here, constantly staying in front of consumers and building that brand, that's pretty cool to see that someone's over here constantly working on your behalf to support your product and build a product name like we've got for U.S. beef.
For more, please visit USMEF.org. For the U.S. Meat Export Federation, I'm John Harith.
This is the AgNet News Hour. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's AgNet West headlines, here's Brian German.
The latest report from the U.S. Department of Agriculture is calling for a significantly larger almond crop compared to last year. The 2024 California almond forecast from USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service predicts production to be at 3 billion pounds, a 21% increase from the year before. The initial subjective forecast also notes that almond-bearing acreage will remain unchanged at 1.38 million acres. Yield per acre is expected to increase to 2,170 pounds. The forecast is based on a survey of 500 almond growers from April 19th to May 5th. Favorable weather conditions during the first half of the growing season, including mild temperatures and increased bee hours, contributed to a successful bloom period. NAS will release a more statistically vigorous objective report in July based on actual almond counts. A recent report highlights the increasing operating costs for farmers while commodity prices have been trending in the opposite direction, squeezing margins and prompting caution in farm investments. Rabobank's semi-annual global fertilizer outlook notes that despite challenges, the fertilizer sector remains resilient with anticipated persistent growth. Nitrogen fertilizer prices have been on a downward trajectory due to reduced demand and lower natural gas prices, while the phosphate market surged in early 2024 due to China's domestic focus, but stabilized with resumed exports. While demand remains uncertain, increased exports of potash from Belarus and Russia have helped increase supply, thus lowering prices. Senior analyst at Farm Inputs at Rabobank, Bruno Fonseca, explained that geopolitical factors, among other issues, could prevent further obstacles. However, growth in fertilizer use is expected to continue. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has announced updates to its regulatory process for intentional genomic alterations in animals known as IGAs. The aim is to modernize evaluation and support innovative animal products. IGAs involve molecular technologies altering animal genomes for purposes like human health improvements and enhanced food production. Two guidance documents were released intended to help industry members understand the existing statutory and regulatory requirements as they apply to IGAs in animals and to inform the public about FDA's process for regulation. FDA is accepting public comments on the revised draft on the approval process for IGAs until July 31st. FDA also signed a Memorandum of Understanding with the USDA to clarify regulatory roles. The initiative corresponds with an executive order focusing on advancing biotechnology for a sustainable American bioeconomy. Federal efforts continue to monitor, prevent, and study a form of highly pathogenic avian influenza found in dairy cattle. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack said they've increased testing, surveillance, and other efforts to protect human and animal health.
At this stage, there's no concern about the safety of the commercial milk supply or beef supply. We continue to see affected cows recover with supportive treatment, with little associated mortality being reported. And it's also important to note that thus far we have found no changes significantly in the virus that would make it more transmissible to humans. As we have said often throughout this process, the initial detection of this virus in dairy cattle, USDA remains committed to evolving its response and course of action. The more we know informs what we do, and we want to make sure that we're doing what is necessary to provide producers on the ground with the most available and most scientific information and direction.
UC Cooperative Extension and the California Potato Research Advisory Board is hosting this year's Kern County Potato Variety Field Day next month at Hart Memorial Park in Bakersfield. Kern County Vegetable Crops Advisor Jaspreet Sidhu described what can be expected from this year's field day.
This year it will be on June 12th, and we will be showcasing our varieties from this year, the early maturing varieties, different kinds of specialties, reds, coloreds, and russet potatoes that we will be showcasing at the trial. And growers will be able to see how they performed in the field, depending on the size, yields, and their performance based on the skin setting. And I think particularly of interest would be the reds and the specialty fingerling potato this year.
More information about the field day is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network.
Representatives Dusty Johnson of South Dakota and David Rouser of North Carolina discussed the Farm Bill and impacts on rural America during a panel discussion moderated by Kip Eideberg, Executive Vice President of Government and Industry Relations and Global Public Policy for the Association of Equipment Manufacturers. We have a segment of that session for you, starting with Eideberg asking a question of Representative Johnson.
You sit on the Agriculture Committee and the Transportation Infrastructure Committee, both of which deal with issues related to supply chains and to our trading relationships. Those are critically important to not just the farm economy, but to rural communities. What opportunities do you see in the next Farm Bill to help strengthen our trading relationships, open up new markets so that we can grow more things here in America and sell it to customers around the world?
Well, both FMD and MAP are very popular bipartisan programs. And we know that, and those are almost money machines, Kip. I mean, you put a little investment in the front end of the machine, and what comes out is many times more money. I mean, the numbers vary based on the program, but you hear numbers like 30 times return on our investment. Pretty impressive. I think you're going to see in this Farm Bill, when it's done cooking, a pretty substantial increase in the investment in FMD and MAP. That's good news. You know, if I was going to take a half a step out of the Farm Bill, I would say we do need this administration to develop a more robust trade agenda. Ambassador Tai is brilliant, but they're pretty honest. They're not going to be working on any more bilaterals and multilaterals. I think that's a major mistake. We know that when you've got a good trade deal, it can mean huge prosperity for America. So that, combined with more marketing dollars with FMD and MAP, I think would do a lot to make sure that we can help feed the world and power the world.
No, I appreciate that answer. And of course, equipment manufacturers depend on trade as well. 30% of all the equipment made in this country is destined for export. So,
And it's hard to overstate the impact on our economy. I mean, in any given year, 60% of South Dakota soybeans and American soybeans go overseas. We're not going to eat that many soybeans here.
Right.
We raise and grow the best corn, beef, beans, dairy. There is almost no limit to how much more we could sell to the rest of the world, provided that we had better deals.
Yeah. No, amen to that. And I'm going to turn it back to you, Congressman Rouser, and give you a chance to answer that same question or go down a different path, but related to the topic of trade, the Farm Bill, and what we can do to help our farmers open up new markets for them.
Well, the bottom line is trade is where the profit is. If you don't have export markets, you're not going to be able to make a profit. And those margins are awfully tight to begin with, especially considering increase in production cost. Labor cost, obviously, are a huge factor. The labor issue is probably one of the most critical aspects of production agriculture today. And there are a lot of issues, quite honestly, that affect agriculture that are not within the jurisdiction of the House Agriculture Committee or the Senate Agriculture Committee, for that matter. But trade certainly is critically important. We need an administration that is really vigorously pursuing new markets. The MAP program, FMD. I remember when I was in the state legislature and we were wanting to promote North Carolina sweet potatoes in the U.K., so I included $300,000 in seed money for that effort, and it was amazing how quickly that took hold. And as Dusty alluded to, mentioned, a little investment there goes such a long, long ways. You have a return so much greater than the investment. And so all those programs are really critically important. Another one under the jurisdiction of the Ag Committee, a category under jurisdiction of the Ag Committee, are the food aid programs as well. And those help substantially, too, in a number of different ways, not just exporting excess food that we have available, but also helping to stabilize regions, and just the goodwill of the American people that is displayed with that goes a long, long way in terms of international relations.
Yeah, I think that's spot on, and I think there's probably a role there, too, in terms of just educating the American people about the importance of trade, not just in terms of what we can sell to countries abroad, but what we can also benefit by bringing products here. So I appreciate the answer. Thank you. Switching topics a little bit, the equipment that you see on the mall here today provides farmers with the tools they need to monitor, to manage, to maximize their farming operations while also advancing climate-smart agriculture and helping to protect our environment. However, with 30% of farmed acres in the United States not having sufficient connectivity, many of the benefits of precision agriculture are not available to farmers. So, Congressman Johnson, you've been a passionate advocate for connecting rural America to reliable, affordable, high-speed internet. Maybe talk a little bit about your efforts and maybe what opportunities you see in the next Farm Bill to help connect more Americans so that we can also benefit from some of this great equipment that's out here.
Yeah, broadband, critically important. Before I came to Congress, that was my career. I was the co-owner of an engineering and consulting firm that focused on rural broadband. That's what we did. We did business in about 40 states, helping about 400 telecommunications providers expand and run these fantastic networks. And periodically, people will try to make this a competition, like, oh, it's wireless is the better approach or fiber is the better approach. Let's be honest. If you're talking about connectivity in the cab of a tractor, you're going to need that last mile may well be wireless. But let's be honest, you cannot get the kind of speed you need without fiber. Lots and lots of fiber in rural America. That's why we need a farm bill, I think, that acknowledges the importance of high speeds. We know that the demand for broadband, for bandwidth, it doubles about every 2 years. It is really, it's a remarkably constant formula. So we want to make sure that we're building networks, not that meet our needs today, but that are going to meet our needs 5 and 7 years from now. Ideally longer than that, but certainly for the next 5 or 7 or 10 years. And I do think when we're talking about taxpayer dollars, you want to even push that timeline out a little bit. I wouldn't necessarily say future-proofed because it is hard to know what the future holds. But I'm happy to say that I think the way that this farm bill is trending right now, we are going to invest in high-speed networks rather than networks that are going to be obsolete the day we flip the switch.
And just a quick follow-up. How do you ensure affordability when it comes to – because some of this technology is expensive. It's expensive to put it in. It's expensive to maintain. But any just thoughts on making sure that, you know, every community can afford it?
I mean, in general, and clearly there is a need in a rich country to have safety net programs. In general, though, I think we put too much attention on government helping people pay for their heating bill and their cooling bill and their broadband and their clothes and their food and their rent and their daycare. And again, for the poorest Americans, we need those programs. I would tell you, I think if we just had government that was right-sized and quit shoveling trillion-dollar packages out the door seemingly every quarter, I think a lot of these prices would stabilize. And I think things would get affordable for Americans so they wouldn't have to look to Washington, D.C. for us to pay a larger portion of their bill. So what can we do in a more natural sort of – and by the way, you and I both know this, Kip. When government does things for people that they can and should do for themselves, we breed dependence. What we want to do is breed independence. We want people to escape poverty. That's certainly the story of my family. One thing we can do, I think, is make sure that there is access to capital so that when companies go out and build, they can do so in a way where those price points can be reasonable for people. It's to the point, obviously, where if you don't have broadband, it is pretty difficult to compete and participate in this modern economy. That's why we got to get those facilities, those networks pushed ever deeper into rural America.
And thank you for indulging me with that follow-up question. I think what you said is spot on, and I think we just need to continue to hammer that message. One of the things that we're doing here...
And again, just to reiterate it, for the poorest Americans, of course, we have always had programs like Lifeline and Link Up. They're going to continue to be a really important part of the story of keeping the poorest Americans connected.
This is the AgNet NewsHour. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. For today's featured interview, I'm talking with Sandro Steinbach about the importance of trade with China for California's agriculture. Steinbach is the director of the Center for Agricultural Policy and Trade Studies at North Dakota State University, though he studied at UC Davis. Here's our interview.
You are at North Dakota State University, but you have been studying California agriculture, and you did this report on California agriculture and trade with China. And so I'd like to start out by asking you, how did this come about? How did you get interested in China and California and the connection there?
Yeah, that's a good question, actually. I did my graduate degree actually at UC Davis and had been working on China and California trade issues for a couple of years. And that issue that we are discussing here, right, the permanent normalized trade relationship with China, is something that had been, you know, brewing up over the last couple of years. And Colin and I, Dr. Colin Carter, he's a professor at UC Davis, thought about we need to do something, actually show what are the potential implications of the policy proposals that are currently out there.
So you found that trade with China is actually very important for California agriculture. Can you tell me a little bit about what you found?
Yeah, sure. Trade with China. I mean, China is one of the biggest recipients of California agriculture products, right? And that trade had been significantly growing for many years, but had been, you know, kind of stagnating during recent years. In our studies, we actually looked into what is the implication of some of the recent policy proposals in DC that look into that consider the China-US trade relationship. And one of the big changes that had been proposed is actually discontinuing the permanent normalized trade relationship with China, which basically granted China WTO access. And our calculation shows that revoking this access actually would mean that agriculture import tariffs would increase by about 9.5%. If you assume that there's some kind of a tit for tat retaliation, as we have seen during the 2018-19 trade war between the United States and China. And crunching the numbers, right, we found that this could potentially mean that California exports alone would be dropping by almost a third or $1 billion annually.
So we did see a drop in trade with China just overall nationally in this last year. Did you see that had much of an effect on California itself?
If you think about industries such as the almond producers, right, had been significantly involved in trading with China and saw some very significant growth over the 2010s, basically, which also led to the significant expansion actually of production area. In recent years, right, prices had been dropping down significantly for those agricultural products that had been particular going into the Chinese markets. With the 2018-19 trade war, California itself saw pretty significant drops in agricultural exports relative to a counterfactual scenario where these tariffs wouldn't have been in place. So there was potential for significantly more growth, but that was hampered actually by the tariffs that came into place. Now China had been in the recent years starting to renegotiate and restructure its foreign trade relationships, expanding significantly into South America, but also into Southeast Asia for the sourcing of agricultural commodities. An example is again almonds that had been particularly relevant due to the expansion of agriculture export out of Australia, for instance, that had been reaching Chinese and Indian markets, for instance. So overall, right, we see that exports had been coming down, but that's also a sign that is very similarly observed for the entire United States. While at the same time, we see that additional threat of new tariffs coming in. I mean, the Biden administration just announced or is announcing new tariffs that are imposed on China, not just on electrical vehicles, but also potentially in including additional agricultural commodities. So concern with these policies is that the policymakers in China are likely to respond to those tariffs by imposing their own tariffs and going into a tit-for-tat retaliation game with the United States. And that tends to harm agricultural products producers in particular. If we, for instance, think about the 2018-19 trade war that had very significant implication across the nation, with particular producers in the Midwest facing disruptions in their ability to access the Chinese market in terms of access for soybeans and corn, those tariffs actually led to significant market interventions, and those market interventions were covering some of the cost. But what we found in some of our earlier work is that particular those producers that operate in California were not made whole by any of the payments that were given out. You have to keep in mind, right, that Midwest agriculture is fairly different to what we produce in California, actually, in terms of agriculture products, because our products tend to be, you know, more value added, actually, and there's a lot more processing going on. And much of what the government is actually caring about and then is making sure that those farmers are off is in the area of basic agricultural or primary agricultural products in that sense.
Yeah, there are big differences in regulations and protections and things as well for Midwest crops, where California crops are specialty crops, don't necessarily have access to the same types of protections when we do lose out. As you mentioned, like the tit-for-tat retaliatory tariffs, when those happen, you know, like you said, in the 2018-19 trade war, and we did see, 15% tariffs or 10% tariffs, are we still feeling the effects of those? Are some of those tariffs still on our crops?
Sure. I mean, some of the tariffs are still in place, actually. Some of them had exemption, actually, for certain periods that lowered the overall tariff level for California agriculture products. But overall, they're in place, and then can be at any time, actually, put back in that sense. So a good example here, right, are again almonds, actually, which saw two types of tariffs that were put in response to 232 and 301. Tariffs imposed by the United States, actually. The 301, right, where had an exemption for a couple of years now, where U.S. exporters needed to meet certain licensing and reporting requirements in China, actually. And those could be put in place at any time when the Chinese government says, okay, well, you're harming our EV car industry, which had been, exploding recently in terms of global market reach. We are targeting those products that harm you, actually. And that's a particular risk that is affecting California agriculture a lot more than any other part of the nation, right? But due to our significant market share in China, actually. And that market share, right? If you think about different components of the California agricultural exports, for certain groups, this market share is about 8.4%, for instance, for horticultural products. But for others, such as livestock and meat, those shares are significantly higher, going up to 22.4%. So overall, what we see that our dependency on the Chinese market had been from 2002 to 2000, when we see expanding significantly from about 3% on average to about 10%. While certain product groups, we send about 30% of all our exports to the Chinese market.
So in kind of wrapping up, I mean, it's hard to wrap all of this up because there is so much information, but what would be a couple of key points that you say we really need to keep our eyes on?
Yeah, so there are several proposals out there right now that are particularly linked to U.S. industrial policy and the upcoming U.S. presidential election, actually, that could have significant implication for U.S. agriculture and foreign market. And that's not just access to the Chinese market, but also access to other markets, right? If we implement broadband tariffs that we had been doing it in 2018-19, those harmed not just our trade relationship with China, but also impacted, for instance, our trade with Turkey and our trade with India, actually. And those trade barriers are still harming our ability to access those markets and sell a large share of our crop. Almonds here, again, are a good example, right? We produce about 80% of the global almonds. And any disruptions to global market access actually are having potentially very significant implications for California producers. And our thought experiment, just taking the prevailing argument or the prevailing scenario actually into account here, which is that we would just revoke the WTO most favored nation rates on China, and assuming that China would react the same as they had been doing in 2018-19, would imply about a 28.4% drop in California agricultural exports. And that's very significant, right? If we think about the overall losses and the amount of jobs connected, but also the amount of rural economy that is connected to those agricultural activities.
And, you know, again, this is just, it's very important for our California crops, our California producers. Would it be okay with you if I shared a link online to this paper of yours that I'm reading that has the information that you've been providing? You know, revoking China's preferred trade status would be costly for California's agriculture. Can I put a link up for that?
Definitely. Would be a good idea.
Perfect. I want to thank you again so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Same here. Appreciate it, Sabrina.
I'll put the link to that report in the description on today's podcast. And you can always find the AgNet NewsHour on your favorite podcast downloading app. You're listening to AgNet NewsHour. To wrap up our day, are we on the fringe of a new trend in U.S. wheat production? Gary Crawford looks into it.
USDA is projecting that the current U.S. winter wheat crop will come in 2% larger than last year.
If realized, this would be the first time in recent history, at least on this table, that we would have consecutive year-over-year increases.
Nick Streff with USDA's Statistics Service, which is forecasting a winter wheat crop of 1.28 billion bushels. Of course, for decades, the U.S. has seen wheat production decline almost every year. So are we on that leading edge of a new trend of more wheat production? USDA's chief economist Seth Meyer says that would be nice.
But these 2 years of increase in a row are not on increases in area 2 years in a row. This year's increase in production relative to last year is on better conditions, improved yields, despite a fall in overall wheat area.
Which Meyer says in the long run will likely continue. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
That's today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halverson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet NewsHour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.